This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega.
New York has been through hell, but the finish line is in sight.
New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo has arguably been one of the most visible politicians during the pandemic. The national media praised his measured tone during his daily press briefings back in the spring when New York City was the epicenter of the virus. And New Yorkers agreed. Polling in July showed that 72% of them approved of how the governor had responded to the crisis. For many, Cuomo's apparent reliance on evidence and facts to guide his decisions was a relief from President Trump's daily lies and misinformation about the virus. Here's Governor Cuomo talking to NBC News back in March.
I don't operate on what I hope or what I would like to see or what my expectation is. I operate on the data and on the numbers and on the science.
Recent reporting from the New York Times, however, shows some cracks in that picture. According to the Times, since the summer, 9 senior New York State Health Department officials have left their positions for being, quote, sidelined and disrespected by Governor Cuomo. By not listening to their advice, some believe the governor has potentially hindered the state's ability to stop the spread of the virus and successfully roll out the vaccine. Here's what Governor Cuomo had to say during a recent press briefing.
When I say experts, in air quotes, it sounds like I'm saying I don't really trust the experts, because I don't. Because I don't.
Jesse McKinley is the Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
So what happened? I mean, why is Governor Cuomo shifting from someone who said he trusted the experts to someone who says he doesn't?
Well, I think that was a pretty shocking remark. I think a lot of jaws dropped, not only in the room, but probably people listening nationwide and across the state. The point I think the governor was trying to make, although he might have been ham-handed about it, was that he did not trust, you know, federal experts and people who had given him bad advice in the past. Now, keep in mind, this has been a steady refrain of the governor, that he feels like the feds let him down, that the virus was coming when they didn't expect it. But the thing that underscores this was our reporting in the paper on Monday, which basically showed that a lot of these so-called experts that he has disdain for are in fact leaving his Department of Health and leaving that department a little bit in the lurch at a time in which the pandemic is still raging here in New York.
You found, in fact, in your reporting that 9 senior New York State Health Department officials have left the department since the summer. Is this tension that you're describing between Governor Cuomo and the essentially state public health officials really what drove that?
I think it's an undercurrent to almost all of those 9 leaving. You know, keep in mind that Governor Cuomo, long before he became kind of the pandemic slayer that he was known last spring and summer, was known for a very heavy-handed approach to state government, and that included the state agencies like the Department of Health that are under his you know, leadership. So he's always been known as a tough boss. But I think the intensity of the pandemic, I think that the fact that he and a very small coterie of aides were dictating policy, often without the Department of Health knowing what was coming, led to enormous tension and also dispirited people in the Department of Health. You know, some of the sources we spoke to spoke of all-time low morale inside of the Department of Health and made the point that oftentimes in situations like this where you're facing a huge crisis, people rise to the challenge and they feel like their expertise and their skill sets are valued. And in many cases, the governor made these people feel like they were not valued and kind of dunderheads, you know, at a time in which he alone knew the best way forward.
I want to get into the governor's decision to work with private hospitals in just a moment. But before that, has the departure of these 9 public health officials had any effect on the actual rollout of the vaccine distribution or, you know, efforts to control the spread of the virus?
It's difficult to say at this point, but what is incontrovertible is that the governor instituted a different plan than the one that was on the books. Now, keep in mind the Department of Health, as well as local departments of health, do max vaccinations. They have done these. They have plans on the books. In 2009, they handled H1N1. There have been past outbreaks. There have been certainly public health vaccinations for everything from measles to other childhood illnesses. Like, this is something that local health departments know how to do and that they have plans to do. And in the case of this pandemic, the governor decided that they would do a different plan, often without informing the local health departments or even his own State Department of Health, that he had a different idea how to do this. And that leads to what you were talking about in using, you know, large hospital systems as kind of the primary, you know, point of contact for vaccinations rather than leaving it up to local health departments or other authorities.
Jesse, you're in Albany. I'm in New York City, and I'm sure I'm not saying something here that doesn't bear, you know, that isn't true when I say that the vaccine rollout, at least in New York City, has been a mess. Part of your reporting suggests that it's because Governor Cuomo decided to put the rollout in the hands of private hospitals instead of in the hands of public health entities. What can you tell us about his decision there?
His justification was threefold, basically. One, he said, look, if you're gonna vaccinate medical workers, the frontline medical workers, who everyone sort of agreed from the feds on down to the state needed to be vaccinated first, where do medical workers work? They work in hospitals. Ipso facto, you should send the vaccines to the hospital chains and they'll inoculate their employees. They also said that in terms of the Pfizer vaccine, which needed this extremely cold storage, the hospitals were more likely to have that. And also, I think there's kind of a larger issue here that Governor Cuomo felt that they could operate regionally rather than being hamstrung by, you know, local jurisdictional lines, whether it be county lines or city lines or things like that, all of which may be justifiable. But as you pointed out, the actual rollout was balky, to say the least, and in some cases, incredibly frustrating for residents who are trying to get shots.
Let's talk about whether or not Governor Cuomo had any political or financial ties to the hospitals and the hospital lobbyists that he worked with, that was revelatory in your reporting here, to achieve his new distribution plan.
Well, you know, money and politics are a common refrain at every level of government. The governor has said repeatedly that money has nothing to do with his decisions, and that may well be true. But in this case, one of the groups that was charged with vaccination was the Greater New York Hospital Association, which is a major donor of the governor, both in the past campaigns and during his 10-plus years as governor of the state of New York. So there are obviously ties between lobbying groups and the governor that are involved in the vaccination efforts. Also, one of the things our reporting uncovered was that lobbyists have been involved since the almost very beginning in formulating policy, running data, at some point advising the governor on courses of action. Inside of the state health department, in fact, we discovered that there was a lobbyist who had been given an office and a desk and was, you know, contributing to the, formulation of state policy right alongside state health employees.
I think, Jesse, what's frustrating about this is that as people, including myself, are trying to get vaccine appointments for our elderly and older relatives and friends, it's just been a frenzy to try and do that. And things are still not exactly where they need to be right now. To think that the governor may have made this decision not because of efficiencies or because it would have worked better for New Yorkers, but because of some perceived political gain?
Well, I'm not so sure about that thesis, but I do think the frustration is real. You know, and in the governor's defense, and to many states' defense, part of this stems from just not enough vaccine to go around. You know, keep in mind that the state of New York is a state of 20 million people, and at last count, I think they're getting about 300,000 doses a week. Now, anyone can do that math. That is going to take a long time to inoculate that entire population, and then multiply that by even bigger states like California and Texas and Florida, all of which are clamoring for vaccine as well. And also the regulations that have been, or at least the guidelines that have been set down by the federal government, you know, have very strict, you know, category 1A, category 1B, category 1C that governments are trying to follow. Now, having said all that, one thing that Governor Cuomo did was basically threaten, providers, healthcare providers, that if they, gave the wrong vaccine to the wrong people at the wrong time, they could, face censure, legal censure, as well as fines. And I think our reporting and other publications reporting found that that sort of heavy-handed approach, threatening fines, may have had something to do with the slow rollout as well, that healthcare providers were scared of getting in trouble or scared of getting fined and thus slowed down their inoculations to the point where you saw the sort of frustration you're talking about.
Well, we know that Governor Cuomo is not one to back down from a confrontation. In fact, he directly responded to your report in the New York Times by saying, quote, "If Times reporters think I push hospitals too hard and local governments too hard, I say I'm a fighter for the people of New York and I believe I'm saving lives." That's a powerful statement. Jesse, what do you make of that response from Governor Cuomo?
Well, I've covered the governor now for 7, 8, 9 years. I've lost track. But, he is nothing if not confident in his own abilities and his worldview. So he definitely thinks that he's doing the right thing. He definitely feels that that coming up with his own plans is a better way of doing it. You know, and his comments about healthcare, people inside of his own state health apparatus have not been necessarily flattering. You know, a couple of weeks ago, even before our story published, he was basically saying that they were academics who didn't know how to get things done. Since our story has published, he said, basically some people just aren't up to the job. So this is not a politician or a leader who feels that, he's got anything wrong. He would point to the fact that the state, the vaccination program has increased in speed in recent weeks. But then by the same token, he has had troubles with keeping data straight. He's had troubles with releasing data, as indicated last week by a very damning report from the state attorney general, a fellow Democrat, Tish James, who said that his health department was undercounting the number of people who had died in nursing homes. And so there are critics beginning to speak up and questioning whether or not his kind of self-confidence is actually earned or is just bluster.
Well, we can only hope that the vaccination rollout just gets better for all New Yorkers and folks across the country. Jesse McKinley is the Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Jesse, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you've been talking to us about this in your own states, and you sent us some voice memos about how you thought your governor is handling COVID. Most of you, pretty happy.
Hi, this is Bobby from Cleveland, Ohio. I'm very happy with the way my governor, Mike DeWine, has handled the pandemic. He gives daily briefings, which include COVID updates. He even delayed the presidential primary election because he cares about Ohio lives. If he runs again, I'll vote for him, and that will be the first time I've ever voted for a Republican.
Hi, my name is Oren, and I live in Colorado. I think our governor, Jared Polis, has done a really good job and has shown really exemplary leadership. From the beginning of the pandemic, he has held regular and very informative news conferences. He always wears a mask when you see him in public. I think he's found a good balance between lockdowns and helping businesses stay afloat.
Hello, my name is Gary, and I'd like to say that Gavin Newsom has done a pretty good job in dealing with the COVID crisis, in that he hasn't received much federal assistance from the past administration. Hopefully he'll receive all that is needed and all of them get on the same page to work together in unison. Federal, states, counties, cities, and things will be better in the future.
Hi, I'm Kerry from Sandy, Oregon, and my governor, Kate Brown, has rocked it during the COVID pandemic. She's followed the advice of scientists closely and made tough interpretations on her own. It hasn't been easy. The advice has changed as we've learned more about how to beat this virus. Communicating the changes is hard, but she's handled it well. Most recently, she's taken flack from many over the prioritization of teachers over the elderly in the vaccine rollout, and that's just a brutal call to have to make. I wouldn't trade her for anyone right now.
I live in California, so my governor is Gavin Newsom. I think he has done a magnificent job considering what a populous state we are and how hard the COVID-19 has hit the state. He locked us down early and I think prevented a lot of deaths that could have occurred.
Some of you are mixed.
My name is Greg Keenan. I run a restaurant in Pennsylvania. I feel Governor Wolf has made the hard decisions. He shut down parts of our economy to control the spread of COVID-19. He's been clear about masks and our part in keeping each other safe. Given that applause, my beefs are twofold. When he shuts down restaurants, he should enforce it. Secondly, there desperately needs to be a statewide database for residents to register with for the vaccine. This doesn't exist, and it's easily created.
And a few others not so pleased.
I'm Liz in Dallas. Touting low taxes and light regulations, Governor Greg Abbott disregards the health needs of the most vulnerable. How else can you provide health care if low taxes is your platform? There's no unified response to this pandemic, and he's putting citizens, students, teachers, staff, all of us in harm's way.
My name is Eric. I live in Queens, New York, and I used to approve of Governor Cuomo's handling of the pandemic, but I recently have changed my opinion. This is mostly due to a graph that the New York Times put out showing that Andrew Cuomo banned indoor dining when the infection rate per every 100,000 people was at 40.2 people, and then he reopened indoor dining and it's 66.1, so that's a 26 person jump, and now we're opening indoor dining. I just don't get it.
Send us your take at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Just record a voice memo and email it to us, or give us a call the old-fashioned way at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
On Sunday, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and Kansas City Chiefs face off in Tampa for Super Bowl 55. And like most things during the COVID-19 pandemic, it's going to look a lot different this year. The Super Bowl usually sells out, sometimes reaching more than 100,000 attendees. But this year, there'll be fewer than 25,000 fans because of the pandemic. The big event also comes at the end of a tumultuous season for the NFL, which saw the league keeping games going, even as multiple teams dealt with COVID-19 outbreaks. And the Super Bowl is also happening against the backdrop of ongoing scrutiny into the league's hiring practices, notably the absence of Black hires in coaching and leadership positions. For more on this, we called up Michael Fletcher, senior writer for ESPN's Enterprise team. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
That was, I have to say, that was a surprise from our control room, my first Super Bowl sounding introduction. Michael, let's start with the Super Bowl. What kind of safety measures have been put in place for the players, for the coaches, the staff, and the people who are supposed to show up?
Well, you know, everything is different this year, as you noted. The players are being tested, from what I understand, twice a day, and they have to pass those tests if they have any contact. If any exposure to the virus, they're held away from the team. Several Kansas City Chiefs are facing that now. There was a bit of a eruption when their team barber was tested positive and everyone had to be kept away. The normal media day, which is always a big spectacle at the Super Bowl, of course, had to be done virtually this year. And as you noted, the fans are going to be, you know, much reduced the number of people in the stands. So overall, what you're going to have, is, in my mind, a muted Super Bowl, even though it's a great matchup. You have these kind of legendary quarterbacks in their own way. But somehow the game is, you know, the game is kind of under this pall that the entire country, the entire world is suffering right now.
So, Michael, after this year's regular season ended, there were six open head coaching positions. Only one of them went to a Black coach. Another position went to the league's first Muslim American coach. But why is there a league where players are almost 70% Black and it's failing to hire Black coaches?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? It's so I think, infuriating to people who are kind of in those coaching pipelines. The league talks a good game. The league itself, you know, promotes the hiring of Black coaches and Black general managers and Black team presidents. But somehow the owners, not comfortable. That's the only thing you can say. They're just not comfortable with hiring black men or women in those positions. It's as simple as that. If you look at the Rooney Rule, for example, for years now, it's been almost two decades that the league has required teams hiring head coaches to interview at least one minority candidate. They recently bolstered that to two. They've incentivized teams to hire or at least develop coaching candidates to give them extra draft choices if they develop people who are hired as team leaders. But if you step back from that, it's interesting that the owners are incentivizing themselves to do the right thing. It's just odd. I think, you know, it's a problem that you probably see not just in the NFL. It's glaring in the NFL, but you see this across this country, across corporate America, where particularly in these key leadership jobs, kind of the face of the franchise jobs, the face of the company jobs, you know, there's a real hesitancy to hire black people to run stuff. And I think it comes down to a kind of a comfortability, because if you're an owner of a team, you want someone that you just 100% relate to run that team. That, in some ways, that's understandable. But what's disappointing is why black people cannot be in that number.
I agree with you there, Michael. I think there are lots of issues that prevent that from happening. And yet, this has also been an issue for black quarterbacks in the NFL. There have been some improvement in that area, right? There are more black quarterbacks now than there have been in the past.
Oh, absolutely. Now, you know, arguably, like, particularly this kind of coming generation of black quarterbacks, I mean, you look no farther than the Super Bowl. Patrick Mahomes is kind of the standard bearer, if you will. You know, I think the consensus is that he's the most talented, the greatest, the best quarterback in the game right now. And he's just, you know, one of many. I mean, he's the biggest name. I turn on my TV, every time I turn it on a Sunday, I see him on my screen playing football and making all kinds of commercials, right? So these guys are huge. These guys are definitely, you know, Mahomes is one, and others will be. You know, people talk about Deshaun Watson. He's considered a top five quarterback. Lamar Jackson was last season's MVP, like the previous season to this one. Kyler Murray was a top pick 2 years ago with the Arizona Cardinals. So you have black quarterbacks, you know, kind of on the rise in the NFL. And I think that ceiling has been broken. You know, I think coaches and teams are now comfortable with black quarterbacks and kind of their style of play, if you will. Not that there's one style of play, because black quarterbacks play just like anybody else. But in the past, the knock was, or the stereotype was, that black quarterbacks are quote-unquote dual-threat quarterbacks, which the word's a good thing in football. You can run and you can pass. But somehow that used to bear a negative connotation, that somehow if you're a good runner, you can't be a good passer. But a lot of these guys in the league now have proven out to be just a myth. The black quarterback myth has been put to rest. I hope it has. It apparently has. And hopefully that will soon be the case for coaches, even though the progress has been negative progress. We've actually seen slippage in that area, but maybe that'll change.
Michael, one of the things the Super Bowl is known for is advertising. Several major brands, including Coke and Budweiser, which are huge brands, are not running ads during the broadcast this year. What's behind that?
I think they don't want to feel tone deaf at this point. I believe, I can't remember which company is going to actually give the money they would normally spend on a Super Bowl commercial to the Ad Council to talk about vaccine awareness, I believe. So again, the COVID situation just intrudes everywhere. You know, we're so used to seeing those Clydesdales, and people talk about, you know, what interesting commercial will come up, and I'm sure it'll be interesting commercials. But again, this damper from the pandemic is hitting there. Well, what I've read is that some of the, I guess, the companies that have sort of done well in the pandemic, the DoorDashes and people like that, will be advertising. But again, you have this kind of pall that I think hangs even over the advertising.
One bright spot potentially in this weekend's festivities will be National Youth Poet Laureate Amanda Gorman, who caught all of our eyes and attention for her fantastic performance at the inauguration last month. She will be performing at the Super Bowl, and she is the first poet to ever perform at the event. What do you make of that, Michael?
You know, it's. I think it's great, right? But you know, what a platform, right? And it's a great platform for the music performers, and it'll be for her as well. You know, but I can't help but be a little cynical about the NFL's intentions here. You know, people talk about virtue signaling rather than doing stuff. Like, and we just talked about the problems the league has, and for whatever reason, in hiring black leadership. You know, but this is something they can do, right? We saw this at the beginning of the year after the uprisings across the country this summer with the NFL, you know, its kind of sudden embrace of Black Lives Matter. And, you know, to be fair, they weren't alone. The NFL did that just like the other sports leagues, just like much of corporate America. So in my mind, you know, it's a great platform, but I think it's the NFL's way of trying to say, we're with the times. We understand kind of the social currents in our country, and we want to signal to the world that we're with that.
Michael, the Super Bowl is usually something that people gather in large events and for. Folks shouldn't be doing that this year because of the pandemic. People, Anthony Fauci, among others, have told people to stay home and celebrate at home. Do you have any plans on how you're going to watch the game on Sunday?
You know, it's gonna no Super Bowl parties here. I'm telling you that. I read somewhere, I think there was a poll maybe a week ago. Hopefully, it's changed. But I read where 25% of Americans still plan to get together with friends to watch the game. Now, myself, I think I'll try to find a chicken wing recipe of some kind, bake some wings, and maybe make a small pitcher of margaritas and watch the game by myself. And if there's an especially exciting moment, I'll yell out to my wife to come watch the replay, and I'm sure she'll say, it looks like the last replay you had me look at, you know, months ago. But
I suspect there will be many.
Alone.
Michael, I suspect you won't be alone in that experience, at least collectively. Michael Fletcher is the senior writer for ESPN's Enterprise team. Michael, thank you so much, and enjoy those wings.
All right, thank you so much.
About 600,000 people go missing every year in the U.S., prompting family members to become amateur detectives. On the trail of one missing person is journalist Tanya Mosley.
Why do you think you hesitated when we first met in telling me the full details about your mother's disappearance?
It's heartbreaking. I didn't want to break your heart.
I'm Kai Wright. Tanya Mosley joins me next time on Notes from America. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
That's the sound of Indian protesters clashing with police on January 29th in New Delhi. The protesters are supporting farmers who have been speaking out for months against the Indian government for passing a series of laws that would deregulate the agricultural industry in the country.
They bring in corporate interests and corporate profits and have allow for an unregulated access for them.
That's Sajid Kaur, the executive director for the Sikh Coalition, a Sikh civil rights organization in the United States. Many of the protesters in India have been Sikhs, and Sikhs around the world have shown support for the movement.
They will effectively worsen already very hard conditions for farmers. And so we're not talking about a small population of people that this affects. We're talking about a massive population.
The Indian government has responded by firing tear gas canisters, beating protesters, and even shutting off the internet for a period of time.
When they were met with these, you know, violent and repressive tactics and finally made it to the outskirts of Delhi, they decided that they were going to stay there until their voices were heard.
The escalating protests in India also represent another geopolitical hurdle for the Biden-Harris administration. Joanna Slater is here to talk about this. She's the India bureau chief for The Washington Post. Joanna, thanks so much for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us what you've been seeing on the ground in India with the protests these past few days. Have they been escalating?
what we've seen is a response by the government to violent clashes that happened on January 26th. Since then, the government has taken fresh steps to prevent any of these protesters from entering the national capital. They've put up fresh barricades, laid barbed wire, and even put spikes in the ground to stop vehicles. But there have not been any clashes as such in recent days.
How large is the protest movement, and is it growing?
It's large. There have been tens of thousands of protesting farmers camped out on the outskirts of Delhi, blocking three major entry points to the city for more than 2 months. It is growing, particularly as I mentioned, after these violent clashes that took place on January 26th, you actually saw a fresh influx of farmers from surrounding areas to add their support to the movement.
And what do we know about the percentage of the population that is made up of farmers in India right now? How large is that population?
Well, a majority of Indians still live in rural areas, so their livelihood is directly or indirectly still connected to agriculture. So that's, you know, more than 600 million people. Not all of them are farmers. Not all of them work directly in agriculture, but certainly they are connected to the farm economy.
And tell us what the living and working conditions are like generally for farmers in India.
Farming in India can be a very tough life, as you might imagine. The majority of Indian farmers are small landholders, so it can be very difficult to make a good living off such small plots of land. In the case of the farmers who are protesting, they tend to come from areas around Delhi, from the states of Punjab, Haryana, and Uttar Pradesh. And what they're particularly concerned about is that the new laws will mean the end of guaranteed prices for rice and wheat, which is a system that has really been the bedrock of a certain degree of prosperity in those areas for decades, and a certain degree of security, in fact, for these farmers.
Joanna, what exactly were the three laws that were passed by the Indian government that farmers are responding to?
So these laws were passed in September, and they contain major changes to agricultural policy. The main thrust of the laws is to deregulate agriculture and make it easier for people to buy and sell anywhere they want. Now, some farmers say these laws are an existential threat. They say it will make it easier for large corporations to exploit farmers in contracts. And again, they're worried that they will essentially put them at the mercy of market forces to their detriment.
What is behind the Indian government's decision to pass these laws?
The government says that these laws are necessary to spur investment in the sector and to liberalize it. Generally, the government says that the old way of doing things in farming has led to some unsustainable practices. For example, it means that more people are planting crops that require a huge amount of water than they should be. And it's also basically resulted in inefficiencies in farming that need to change.
We've seen that there have been clashes, but I think part of this conversation and part of why it's beginning to get a bigger, more attention on the international stage is because of the response by Modi's government to the protests. Can you give us a sense of how violent the crackdown has been since this started?
The reaction to the clashes in Delhi has been swift. The government shut down mobile internet at the protest sites and in some neighboring districts, both to quell the demonstrations and to tamp down on communication with the outside world. Two journalists were arrested. There were a slew of police complaints against the farmer leaders, a lot of disturbing legal actions taken against politicians and journalists. But there has not been a violent crackdown on farmers since January 26th.
And what's prevented it from escalating?
Well, as of now, it's still very tense. It's very tense. You have tens of thousands of people still camped out at these three places. You have a very large police presence. You have barricading at these places that looks kind of more like an international border than a city in the heart of India. So the potential for clashes, for something to happen, is very much there. I mean, there was, you know, there was one incident a couple of days ago where a crowd came to one of the sites and started throwing stones and trying to burn down some of the farmer tents. So you can see that there are these kind of incidents that could easily escalate into something more very, very quickly.
What does this tell us about the support in India for Prime Minister Modi?
Well, at the moment, the prime minister is very popular here. He remains very popular here, but this is a major challenge for him. It is a durable and organized protest movement. The farmers and the government have had numerous rounds of talks, and they have failed to reach any kind of a compromise. That the government offered to withdraw the farm laws for a year and a half, and the farmers said no. Their demand is that the farm laws have to be repealed. And I think that's because there's a total deficit of trust between the farmers and the government right now. It's worth noting this is the second major protest movement that the Modi government has dealt with in a year. Last year, there were also nationwide protests over a new citizenship law that critics say discriminates against Muslims. So it's a challenge for the Modi government, but they, for now, it does not appear to be translating into a real dent in support.
Well, let's talk about what we have had a change in administration here in the United States. Trump and Modi appear to have a relatively good relationship. There was a visit from Modi, Prime Minister Modi, to the United States while President Trump was in office. What do you expect to see under the Biden-Harris administration towards Prime Minister Modi?
You're absolutely right. Modi and Trump got along very well. They had an unforgettable rally here in India last year. But strangely, I think this is one relationship where we probably will get more continuity than change, even with the new administration. India and the United States are both worried about China, and they've been deepening security cooperation for years, regardless of which party the president belongs to. So I don't expect major changes. One thing, however, we may certainly see more of is I would expect a little more frank and open discussion of American concerns when it comes to the direction that India's democracy is heading. Trump administration officials say they raised issues such as the government's treatment of minorities, especially Muslims, behind closed doors. But I think it's likely we'll see more discussion of these questions in public. But again, it will probably be framed as an honest discussion among friends. India and the U.S. are both really important to each other right now for strategic reasons, and I think that will override everything else.
Joanna, the strategic reasons being?
India is very concerned about Chinese aggression in the region, and especially on India's border. China and India just had their deadliest clash in more than 50 years back in June. And for the United States, which is also seeking in its way to manage or contain a rising China, really needs a strong India as one of the linchpins of that strategy. India, Japan, Australia, all traditional Japan and Australia, traditional U.S. allies, but India is just crucial to that strategy.
Joanna Slater is the India Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Joanna, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back. Over the past two decades, the writer and director Nanochka Khan has left her mark on the comedy world. From writing for American Dad to show running Fresh Off the Boat to directing Netflix's Always Be My Maybe, Khan has shaped a long list of cultural touchstones. Later this month, Khan is back with another sitcom that delves into the backstory of a celebrity before he was famous. Young Rock, which Khan co-created, is based on the life of Dwayne The Rock Johnson. The series follows Johnson from his childhood in Hawaii to his days as a football player for the University of Miami. And Khan says there's something that appeals to her about the personal stories of these larger-than-life figures.
What's interesting to me is the roadmap of people before they get to where they're going. And I think somebody like Dwayne, his road was so twisty and, you know, there were so many turns and there were so many ups and downs. And, you know, he's one of the most famous people on the planet. So I think that there's some familiarity with him, even, you know, cursory, like in passing. But I think there's a lot that people don't know about him. And I think it's fascinating, you know, how do you get from point A to point B to point Z? And that those are fun stories to tell.
Ahead of the February 16th premiere of Young Rock, I spoke with Khan about the show and whether Hollywood is finally starting to greenlight more projects like the one she's made, often centered around Asian American and Pacific Islander characters.
It's certainly trending in the right direction, but you know, when you start standing still, there's a lot of road to reach before you're actually running, you know, and I think the more movies, shows, anything, any sort of media element that centers people of color, that centers women of color, is a good thing. And I think there just has to be more. And, you know, there's more than there has ever been, but there's still a long road to go.
On so many different levels. I mean, your own family is Iranian American, and I'm wondering if you've ever considered either creating media that reflects that experience, or what your sense is of the Iranian American story as it relates to our broader media. I mean, how many, you know, actors or writers or producers are doing what you're doing right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge. I mean, I would love to, and I'm investigating different projects, you know, circling that sort of area, because I think, look, everybody's experience is so unique and so different, but there is like a shared sort of certain cultural touchstones that I think when people see reflected in any, you know, movies, TV, whatever, resonates with them. And for me, I would love to find something that can sort of bring my experience being an Iranian American and also, you know, a queer American. You know, I have a lot of intersections in my life. You know, I'm a gay woman of color, and those are like, those stories are fewer and farther between. So, and that experience is very specific. You know, that's not everyone else's. So, I think it's a challenge, and it's something that I would definitely and am, you know, am certainly looking to explore.
We both work in industries that, as women of color, at least, that we are often one of few in Hollywood, in writers' rooms, in newsrooms. You've spoken about being the only woman in the writer's room, especially when you were starting out in Hollywood. Is it still a boys' club, or has it gotten better?
It's certainly gotten better. You know, I think that there's so many great shows out there. Honestly, you can I think, track it back to the more opportunities to create content for different kinds of creators. You know, once the kind of the disruptors came in, you know, all the streaming platforms sort of blew everything up. And there's so many more opportunities for people to tell their stories. It's not just, you know, a handful of cable and a handful of broadcast. I think when the opportunities opened up, the people who sort of are now getting chances, you know, are people of color, women of color, queer creators. And I think it's getting better for sure, you know, just because there's more opportunity. And, you know, it's tough for me to answer, is it still a boys' club? Because I've been lucky enough to kind of, you know, be leading the charge on my own projects for a while. So I make sure that it's not, you know, but I can't, you know, I'd be curious, you know, being a staff writer today on someone else's show, you know, what does that feel like? I definitely would think it would be better, but I don't know if it's a true parody yet. I'm sure it's not.
You've worked in film, you've worked specifically in Always Be My Maybe was a deal with Netflix, which, you know, sort of like you said, was a disruptor, really changed the paradigm. But you're also working with network television. Do you see there, other than sort of the opportunity limitations that network television has that maybe Netflix may not have, is there a reason why you want to continue working with networks in addition to working with places like Netflix?
Yeah, you know, for me, I'm really interested in telling all kinds of stories, and it just depends on the creative project. You know, something like Young Rock, because Dwayne is so big, like we said, you know, he has such a big tent, like his stories, I think, can really resonate with a lot of people. I think it's a big tent show. I think it's a show that can appeal to a lot of different age ranges, you know, cultures. Like, it's just, it's like Dwayne himself. And I think there's a lot of optimism and positivity in hearing his story. And there's a lot of hardships that he goes through. But I think it's okay, because you know that, you know, Dwayne turns out all right in the end. You know what I mean? You're not too worried about him. So you can live in those sort of emotional moments a little more in Young Rock that maybe then, you know, in your traditional network sitcom. But I think going back and forth between something like that and then, you know, making films for Netflix, it just sort of, it scratches all the itches, you know what I mean? It hits all the buttons, because then you can kind of tailor things in different ways, you know? And that, again, is a testament to sort of where we are now in terms of the content demand, you know, that the fact that there are options and we don't have to just tailor it one way or the other. You know, it's a good time to be telling these kinds of stories.
We're obviously in a pandemic, and we have been now going on a year. But that hasn't stopped creatives and film production crews from working necessarily. I actually passed one recently, not too far from where I live here in New York, that we're filming. And so I'm wondering what that's been like to film during a pandemic. I know that you all have shifted production for Young Rock from Los Angeles to Australia. That's a pretty big shift. But what else has it been like?
Oh, man. I mean, it's been a real challenge, you know, in all the ways that you think, you know, in all of the COVID precautions and the safety requirements, all which are extremely important and necessary. And, you know, everybody's in their pod. It just changes the entire way the production is run from how we've all been used to. So there's that. But also creatively, it's been a challenge, because, you know, as a director and as a writer producer on set, you know, working with the actors is something that it's so integral into what I do. And it's been a challenge. You know, you've got masks on, you've got face shields on, and you're trying to express with your eyes and you know what I mean? Like, it's just a different way of communicating that I think is something that, you know, had to kind of be learned, and, you know, you have to get used to that. But yeah, we were lucky enough to go down to Australia, and, you know, which they've handled the pandemic in a completely different way. You know, we were happy that Universal TV Group sort of made that deal, and we were, you know, able to go down there and then to Atlanta after that and shoot some stuff with Dwayne there. So
hope all of you are out there staying safe. It's definitely crazy times that we're in right now. But given that fact that we're in these, you know, unprecedented, I know that word has been used so much, but we really are in unprecedented times. And they can be challenging. They can be difficult. Lots of folks are really having, you know, hitting the wall, if you will. And one thing we're doing is asking a lot of our guests how they have been, more than coping, how they're finding joy in the moment. How are you finding joy, Nanochka?
Honestly, like, being able to be creative is a big part of it. You know, having had that opportunity to make Young Rock during this past year was a huge factor for me, because it's one thing where we're all sort of isolated in our houses and in, you know, with our own households, and you can't really see friends, you can't see extended family. And the way that I like to communicate and sort of bring joy to others is by storytelling. I mean, that's what I do. That's what I've always done. And so that brought me joy, you know, being able to know that I can still have these stories be filmed and shot and, you know, have these reach other people that are maybe feeling just as isolated. You know, it's something about sort of connecting through storytelling that made me really happy. So that's really what I'm focusing on.
Nanochka Khan is the creator and showrunner for Young Rock. Nanochka, thanks so much.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, everybody, that's all we've got for The Takeaway today. But I want to say a huge thank you to our GBH Boston producer, Jason Tureski, who leaves us today for a great new opportunity. Jason has been a creative force on the team, and his pitches on everything from lullabies to women magicians to the meat industry will be sorely missed. We hope you stay in touch, Jason. And as always, thanks to the rest of the team for making this show every week. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer. Our board operators are Vince Fairchild and Sham Sundra. Lee Hill is our executive producer. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Our line producer is Jackie Martin. And our producer crew is Amber Hall, Jose Olivares, Ethan Oberman, Jason Tureski, Meg Dalton, Patricia Jacob, and Lydia McMullen Laird. David Gable is our executive assistant extraordinaire. Also, we have a big announcement for our show and the Takeaway listeners. Starting on March 5th, I'm going to be with you 5 days a week. Our dear colleague, Amy Walter, is ending her tenure on Politics with Amy Walter after more than 2 great years covering a very wild Washington. And she's been a great teammate, and we wish her the best. She's still on for the rest of the month, including tomorrow. And a whole new era begins in March with me hanging out with you 5 days a week. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.